What can one of the OGs in food blogging teach you about cooking? Well, it depends on what you already know, but there's a good chance he can help. My guest today has one of the best food blogs as rated by the people who do that kind of thing, so you know he must be doing something right. We get into how he came to be a food blogger, what got him into cooking, and where that's taken him. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 202.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Chef Dennis Litley is my guest today. Chef Dennis, of Ask Chef Dennis fame, talks about how he got started in food blogging, traveling the world to eat, yeah, rough job, huh? And how long is long enough for excellent spaghetti sauce. Dennis started his culinary career just like so many of us, jumping into the deep end. Since then, he's had years of training and worked in many kitchens. Hello, Dennis. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, my pleasure, too. I'm glad we're here. So before we get into our talk today, and basically we're wrapping food and cooking, and that's, I'm going to kind of get into maybe how those who say they can't really can. And that's a niche I'm trying to address too. Give us a bit of a bio about you and how you got where you are.
Sure. I started as a line, well, not even a line cook. I started as a prep guy at a restaurant in Ocean City, New Jersey, and worked my way under the line as a line cook. And finally, by the end of the season, the owner got stung by 15 bees or yellow jackets, and they had to pump him full of drugs to put him to sleep. And because he wasn't allergic, but that was a lot. And I ended up cooking that night. So that was really the beginning of my career as the chef, the sous chef in the kitchen. Trial by fire, and I passed it that night. And after that, I just continued my training. They kept teaching me stuff that I would need to run restaurants and just kept going on. And I became a blogger sort of accidentally. I was at a school. The last job I had was at a school in Pennsylvania, an all-girls high school. And after a few years, I decided I needed to start training my own staff because the attempts you would get were just horrible. So I started a culinary program, you know, and it was like, wow, it became, you know, highly successful. And I trained my girls, and they were just, you know, I wasn't trying to train little chefs. I just wanted them to learn how to feed their families. That was it. I always talk about, I want to demystify cooking, you know, and my favorite saying was, it's not rocket science. So it was there that I really started getting involved in teaching culinary. And I did that for the last 4 years I was at the school. And then my body was just breaking down. Needed another carpal tunnel surgery. I'd had two. They wouldn't do a third. I tore my rotator cuff in the beginning of the year and never got it fixed. So they were like, well, it's just dead now. We can't do anything for you. And my back was failing. So We retired. My wife retired early from teaching because the governor of that time was really making a lot of changes, and she was driving her crazy. So she retired early. I had to retire, and we moved to Florida. And at Florida, I really started paying attention to being a blogger and really started working on it. And that's kind of where I had the time, because I had nothing else to do, to just get in there and cook things, work on social media, go out and meet people. And it just really kind of took off over the last 6 years. It's just been an amazing journey as things have just kept increasing and increasing.
I'm curious, where did you land in Florida?
Kissimmee.
Get out of town. I lived in Cocoa.
Okay. Yeah, we loved Coco. We were in Kissimmee because friends of ours lived in a modular home there. And we, at the time we moved, you know, it financially, we were just going to be okay. You know, it wasn't looking like it was going to be a lot of fancy stuff for us, you know.
And luckily, you were in Kissimmee. There is no fancy stuff in Kissimmee.
Oh, I know. So, but we had a good gig there. And then I just started, my business started booming, and we were able to buy this condo on the water last year. And we sold our Florida house. We're going to be wintering in St. Augustine this year. So it'll be a nice change from that area. It was just getting too busy, too crazy. Yeah. The traffic, I mean, they were building, when we moved there, it was nothing but cow pastures. And over the course of the years, the traffic was just insane. So worse than New Jersey. I was like, this is crazy.
Well, now that's bad, because New Jersey traffic is notoriously terrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
All right. So, yeah, when I was there, there was nothing but cow pastures, middle of the nights, and then more cow pastures.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The coast everywhere is getting built up. We're in an area in St. Augustine that's on the strip by the beach, so they haven't changed that much. You go over like another mile or two to, I forget what road it is, 100 or something, and then it gets nuts again. But right where we're staying, so I don't know if we can afford to buy there, and I don't know if I want a second home at this point either.
Right. You know,
it's going to be 69 this year. I don't know if I'm up for that, so we might just rent.
That's a good idea. All right. So you mentioned blogging, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it's in the world of blogging, you're kind of one of the OGs. You've been at this a long time.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I'm curious is, in I guess this partly depends on getting feedback from the people who view your blog. Do you, how has, this is a terribly unfair question, how has the public's perception of food changed since you've started blogging? What seems really different now than it was when you began?
There's a lot more specialized diets that we're seeing. You know, when I first started, there was gluten-free, and there was no like gluten-free stuff. And I tried learning how to cook that. But now, you know, there's so many great specialty bloggers. People ask me sometimes to adapt a recipe. I says, you know, well, I could. It's going to take me like 2 or 3 days, though, and I don't have that kind of time to do that. So I think more specialty diets, and the niche has grown substantially, where there's, you know, vegan, vegetarian, dairy-free, nut-free, gluten-free, you know, egg-free. I mean, there's just, it's just proliferated, and it's good, because the people that can't eat that stuff now have a resource. But I would think that is the biggest change. You know, I don't think the viewpoint on cooking at home changed with the pandemic. And people realized they had to cook because they couldn't go out. I think a byproduct of that was that people realized how much money they were saving. Right. And I think that's where my blog really became even more popular, because I was giving them restaurant quality, restaurant style dishes that weren't difficult. You know, my stuff takes 20 to 30 minutes for the most part. Every now and then it'll creep up to an hour. But for the most part, it's in that sweet spot, because in a restaurant, that's how long it would take us to cook your dinner. You know, that's how much time we have to get the food, get you a salad, maybe an appetizer, get the food out to you, get you dessert, and turn that table so we can make some more money. So nothing really takes that long, unless it's something that just needs to be prepped, like my marinara. I've started cooking that, my spaghetti sauce. I've started cooking that for 6 hours now because I have the time. And before, it would go 3, maybe 4, and I was happy with that. So now I have the time to crank it to 6 or 7, and it just comes out so good.
All right. So let me ask you, what, I know the answer, but I want to okay, get from you. I think, well, I know my answer, and this is why I'm asking the question. So at 3 to 4 hours, without giving any secrets, and maybe there aren't any secrets, what are you starting with? And so your pan's on the stove. What's the first thing going in the pot for your spaghetti sauce?
Well, you know, because we eat meat, my wife loves having sausage or some kind of pork. She grew, even though I told you she was Polish, she grew up with her mom making that kind of sauce because she was from Philly. And in Philly, they made their gravy. Sunday gravy. So she was used to having that. So that was something I changed. In the restaurant, it would start with chopped onions and garlic and olive oil. And now it starts with the sausage, and I brown the sausage really, really well. Then I put the onions and garlic in it with some more olive oil. And then after that, it's just kind of browned a little bit. You don't want the garlic to burn. Then I use San Marzano tomatoes, which are the best tomatoes you can find. They're from the Mount Vesuvius region of Italy, and they're low acid. And they are also whole tomatoes and juice. If you see something that says San Marzano and it's crushed, it is not, because the only way they're allowed to sell them is whole and juice. So I start them, and I have, my wife again doesn't like chunky sauce. So I start with an immersion blender, and I blend in the can. I buy number 10 cans because I hate opening cans. Hmm. And most of our grocery stores sell them now with tomatoes. Right. And so I puree that up good, dump it in the sauce. And then my seasonings are basil, and I put half of it in while it's cooking, and I put half of it in at the end. So it's fresh chopped basil, sea salt, black pepper, and just a little bit of sugar, just to take a little of the acidic edge off.
Very,
and again,
Sicilian of you.
Yeah, and you know, people say, oh, there's no sugar in tomato sauce. It says, well, you know, there is, and it's sugar is a flavor enhancer just like salt is. And as long as I'm not eating cupfuls, you know, it's not going to kill me because I don't eat much sugar. So that little bit in there, but it just perks it just a little bit, just gives it that lift. And that's it. And then it goes on, like I said, for 3 to 4 hours, depending on what time I would have in the restaurant. I would start it first thing, and then I would carry it off. And home now, I bought a big rondo. It's a big 12-quart deep flat pan, which is about maybe 8 inches high. So it gives you a nice big surface, and the sauce just kind of cooks in that and cooks in that. And I stir it, and I add a little more water to it because I'm letting it go a long time, and it's going to get really, really thick. Mm-hmm. But as it cooks, there was an Italian grandmother on it during the pandemic. She says, that's where the magic starts. And she's going, you leave it on for overnight. Oh, and it's golden. You leave it on for 2 days. And it's like, oh my God, you know, it's like, it just gets better and better. And then the trick, if you cook it long enough, you don't have to let it rest. But if you let it rest till the next day, like I always make enough to freeze. So I never freeze it right away. I package it and I put it in the refrigerator for 2 days. And the flavor enhances. As it sits, the flavors get better, and then I freeze it.
Well, the flavor development works in damn near everything that you're making. It's always better the next day, and that's one of the secrets to a really good soup. Can you? Yeah. This is hard because describing flavor is a tough thing to do because it really is only your perception, and not everybody
subjective.
Is going to.
Yeah.
Well, I don't taste what he's tasting. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I don't get bitter. Some people don't taste bitter at all.
Yeah.
But in the course of, so you put your tomatoes in and you bring it to a boil, can you make an observation about what that tastes like as soon as the sauce comes to a boil? And then what's going on? How, this is a quality assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, and this is tough, and can you describe what the character is of the sauce after 6 hours and why that 6 hours of time is important and it's not done in 20 minutes?
In the first 20 minutes of cooking the sauce as it comes to a boil, you're basically, if there was no meat in it, would be making type of a marinara. And that's truly the only marinara there is. In Italy, they do put a little oregano in it and no basil. You know, it's a little different. But it's a fast sauce. So it will be, at that point, it'll be bright red. It'll be a little sharp from the tomatoes, because it hasn't cooked down. And it will be very fresh tasting. Okay. It will have no depth of flavor. It will have no real, you're not going to taste layers. You're not going to, it's not going to be something you're going to go, oh my God. Okay. That's about the best way. So it's going to be bright and fresh and it's going to be tasty, but you know, you're probably going to use a lot more Parmesan cheese on it because it's not going to have a depth of flavor to it. When it cooks past those 4 hours, up into 6 hours, it becomes very rich. The sauce develops a depth of flavor. It develops a complexity of flavor. It has reduced and built, and everything is broken down. The sugars are really caramelizing, and it's becoming rounder. It's becoming more flavorful. It's going to be one of those, you put it in your mouth and you moan kind of moments at that point. And again, when I'm done with it, sometimes it needs to be reseasoned. So before I get that, oh my God moment, I'll have to check it and maybe add a little more salt. My new basil goes in then too. So it picks up some of the flavor from that and then it freezes. So you're getting a lot more depth. It's just really, I'm trying to think of what, it's like maybe getting a burger from McDonald's and getting one from Five Guys or a fancier burger place where they're putting a little more into it. You know, I love McDonald's burgers, but I mean, you're going to get that and it's going to satisfy. It's going to be tasty, but you're mostly tasting the condiments. And the other one you're actually going to get to taste, or I don't know, Five Guys was a good example, but someone who mixes brisket in with the meat. So you have a little different flavor into the meat. So, you know, you're going to develop more of a complexity. So it's with anything you can cook pretty much, except I guess desserts, it'll get better to a point. You know, proteins, not as much, but sauces, you know, I don't know. I have to think that through. I mean, that wasn't the right statement either. But with spaghetti sauce, definitely. And I either make it with sausage or I make it with meatballs. And sometimes I make it with both.
I think there is a point of diminishing returns where,
yes,
and so the Italian grandma do it for 2 days. There certainly is a romance to that. And
yes,
and
yes,
and romance is definitely a valid component of food. But in terms of flavor goes, yeah, I don't think it's anything. I think
you hit a point. Yeah. And she's going to use bones too, because the sausage honestly would not hold up
right
that long. It'll start to break down. So same thing with my bolognese. I make a bolognese and I let it simmer for 5 hours, you know, and it is just freaking unbelievable at that point.
I think using a different flavor discipline, which would be wine tasting, what it sounds to me like you're describing is that 20-minute marinara is going to be bright and the flavor profile is immediately on the front of the tongue. You get it all right away, but then there's nothing there. And wine, so we tease the wine snobs who are swirling it, looking at it, like, oh, look at the legs on this. Oh, shut up.
Yeah.
But there's a good wine that's been open for a while. So you get that initial, you get that first flavor. Say, oh, okay, I taste this. And then you swallow it and you take the air over your tongue and then stuff happens. And then you get these flavors in the middle of your tongue and the back of your tongue. And it sounds like that's what you're saying happens in that sauce, is it's literally transforming from the few things that are there into something greater. It's a gestalt thing. It's greater than the sum of its parts.
Absolutely. Yep.
And this is something that anybody can do.
Oh, yeah.
But
and it's not something you will get at a restaurant either, because most restaurants don't have that kind of time. You're going to get that 3-hour sauce if you're lucky, and it'll still be good. But, you know, like 3 or 4 hour sauce is still much better than, you know, anything that's going to take less time. But, you know, when you can give it that little bit more time, yeah, then it's going to be magic.
Well, if they've got their mise en place in order, I'm using this words, not cook words. They're making sauce today for tomorrow anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a matter of, like, I don't, you know, in the old days, we would leave a pot on with the bones. We'd roast the bones, throw them in a pot, and leave it on overnight in the restaurant to reduce so we would make our stock.
Right.
Leaving it on overnight in the restaurant, I don't know if that's a good idea with the sauce. And then you would have to get up first thing in the morning and put it on so you could get it off by dinner time, because that stove space becomes, the real estate becomes very, you need it. You need it for everything you're going to be making.
Have to trust that the dishwasher didn't tweak your flame, and now you've got nothing but carbon on the bottom of your pan.
There's a lot of things that can go wrong.
So many. You know, you probably get the same stupid questions I get, and maybe they mean well. What's your specialty? What's your favorite thing to cook? I was like, oh, good Lord. So I really genuinely don't like those questions because I don't even know what they're trying to accomplish. So I come up with cauliflower or broccoli, although cauliflower is interesting.
Yes, it is.
But a really good question, and you brought it up, is making restaurant quality food. Now, after the dumb questions, they'll say, you know, how come I can't make dinner at home taste like dinner at my favorite restaurant? Now,
very simple.
It can be very simple. There's also probably a lot of complex answers that go into that. It includes refrigeration space, the amount of spendable cash, ingredient list. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. But all of those things, doesn't matter. The pan doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you get the best onion or the worst onion. You need a fresh onion. So for people who are deciding they want to go ahead and take that 20-minute sauce to 3 or 4 hours and watch those flavors develop, how do people get their minds into the position of thinking like a restaurant cook to develop flavors? What is going on in the restaurant kitchen that's probably not happening in the home kitchen?
Well, first of all, you've had years of experience put into that restaurant kitchen. And in some instances, it's simply trust the process. You know, that's basically what a lot of it comes down to. Trust the process. And as you're learning how the process works, then you tweak it to make it better for your individual style. And that is not really any different for a home cook. One of the things I always tell people, you know, they'll make recipes and they think just because I did or some other chef told them that this has to be in there, that they can't leave it out. And nothing could be further from the truth. You need to cook with ingredients that you enjoy eating. Because if you make a dish with something you don't like, after you spend all that time in the kitchen and you serve it and you don't like it and your family doesn't like it, there's going to be no joy in the kitchen. You know, so, you know, if you don't like, I make shrimp and broccoli. If you don't like broccoli, leave it out. Let's put asparagus in. Let's put spinach in. Let's put a combination zucchini. You know, use vegetables or use ingredients that you like to eat. Because if you serve the dinner and everybody goes, wow, this is delicious, you're going to want to go back in the kitchen again and make something else. So it's learning to keep, you know, certain things, items, and there'll be items that you like to eat. They don't need to be anything crazy. I mean, I have probably 8 or 10 types of pasta in my house. You don't have to get that crazy. I'm just anal. You know, I have all different kinds of tomatoes and different things. Yeah, it's about having the ingredients that you like to eat on hand. When I start shopping, whenever I go to the grocery store, the first thing I do, and they make it easy because I think all grocery stores start at produce, I look and I find what's the freshest and what is local. That is the produce that I tried to buy. And then I think of them in those terms and then plan my meals around what I can get. I'm not saying, you know, I buy all my meats online from small farms. So I've always got chicken in the house. I've always got pork in the house. I've got seafood in the house. I don't need to buy that, but let me see what I before I left Florida, broccolini was running. So I bought a bunch of broccolini and I had fun with that. What else is fresh? What looks good? You know, and if you, and then go to the meats and then decide, or the proteins, if you're, you know, whatever you're going to use, the fish, the fresh fish, you know, and try and build your meals around the fresh and the most local produce you can find. Because that's where, as long as you don't overcook that produce, that's where you're going to get a lot more return for your money. And then you're going to build some kind of a sauce, or you're going to grill it, you're going to marinate it, or you're going to just season it with olive oil, salt, and pepper, which is what I do with a lot of things, and roast it or grill it. You know, simple. Let the flavor shine through and make those side dishes pop.
So the first thing I think you're saying is come into the kitchen with joy in your heart and happy expectations of eating something you want to eat.
Yes.
Because I've never cooked, never had chitlins, and I'm in no hurry to start.
So, oh, there's things I don't like to cook either. I have learned that I had to do it over the years because some of my customers wanted it.
Well, that's a different story.
I was never a big calamari fan or octopus. And I had the most amazing octopus that I could ever imagine in Barcelona. It was just, oh my God, it was good. Mm. And so, I mean, but again, then it's time. Once you find that joy, and once you're having fun, then you can go outside of your comfort zone a little. Because you know you can cook happy food. You know that your family's happy with what you make. So now let's then try something that you've never tried. Or you're not really sure you don't like it. I'm not telling you to try something you don't like, but try something new or try a new recipe or technique and look at it. And then what happens is as you've learned to find joy in the kitchen and replace items, now as you're making this new dish, you can look at it a little differently. And you can say, what does it need? You know, I left the mushrooms out. What else can I put in there? You know, what can I do to this? What kind of a sauce can I make with it? You know, and again, simple sauces. I tell people they should buy as a product called Better Than Bouillon in the grocery stores. It's a little 8-ounce jar of chicken base, vegetable base, beef base. You can buy in a restaurant. As a chef these days, we use soup bases. I buy Miners off of Amazon. But these are pretty darn good, considering some of the different things that are out there. So that's, again, a way to build a sauce in a dish that you're making. You know, you saute something in a pan and you will cook it to a point, you know, you've got vegetables or whatever else in there, and then you'll hit it with a little white wine to stop the cooking process, deglaze the pan, and get all those tasty little bits that have stuck to the pan released so they add more flavor to the sauce. And then I would add a little bit of that chicken stock into it. And believe me, this stuff in the jar is so much better than those boxes that they sell over. Oh my God, those are hard. This has a lot better flavor. So you put that in, and then to finish it, if you want to tighten the sauce, you season it, you re-season it, you grab a piece of butter and you push it in flour and you squeeze the flour into it real good. And then you put it in the sauce that's boiling and stir it around. And that thickens the sauce. That's called a beurre manier. And that beurre manier with the flour thickens the sauce. The butter adds a little richness. Because if you're going to add butter or really good olive oil, you always do it at the end. That's when you'll taste it, not in the beginning or during the cooking process.
You said, trust the process. I'm imagining mm-hmm. there's a fair amount of listeners who are sort of new to cooking, and they're going, that's not information. Yeah. What? So, and
Well, so then trust the recipe. You know, if I'm telling you that this works, don't think too hard about it. Don't overthink it. So when I was first learning to cook, this is what they taught me to make. So I trusted the process of all his knowledge. So trust the process and trust my knowledge and trust my ability. Now, if I'm putting something there that just turns your stomach, leave it out. Again, you have control. So that's the process I'm talking about. And you can't, sadly, trust the process with everyone, because some things are just made for SEO to get a lot of hits. Some things, you know, they don't even really test the recipes. They just throw everything together. They take really pretty pictures, and then they're leaving something out, or they screwed up the process somewhere in between, and it's not going to come out as good as you would. The Food Network is famous for that. They have a lot of their people. And it's, again, because they're not doing it. They've got someone on staff writing up these recipes and putting them under their name. So when you find someone that really kind of has a clue what they're doing, and they're providing you with time-tested recipes. These are recipes that I made in my kitchens over 35 years. Okay, these are recipes that I continue to make at home. So that's where the process comes in.
I have made the claim and gotten some flack for it in some food Facebook groups that a recipe is only the list of ingredients.
Yes.
The procedure, while it might be on the same piece of paper or the same digital document or even on the same page in the cookbook, the procedure is a whole different ballgame compared to the list of ingredients.
Oh, yeah.
You and I can come to the same exact sheet pan of ingredients, and through two very different procedures and cooking processes, make two completely different dishes from the exact same ingredients. And so, what is your view on that on the procedure? The written procedure, especially for the novice cook, is a make or break situation, and that's the place for the cook to really teach. What's going on in the pan?
A lot of what I do now, too, and it wasn't something I started when I first started blogging, was I take step-by-step pictures of a lot of things, you know, a lot of the process, so you can see what's going in, how it, then it gets folded in, then this goes in, and that gets mixed in, and then you heat it for 30 minutes. So I'm trying to not dumb down the process, but make it more understandable. And by having these step-by-step pictures, you know, pictures worth a thousand words, if I can see something and read it, then when I read it again, it goes, it'll click sometimes. And I'll go, oh, that's what they mean. Sometimes I look at it and go, I have no freaking clue. But you know, for the most part, I can figure something out. So when you're just starting and you're looking at those ingredients and you have absolutely no skill, this is where, you know, finding someone that you can trust and you can make, you know, whether it's me or someone else, that you can make their recipes and try and get that basic knowledge. Because once you get that basic knowledge, it's like any other job or any other career choice or something that you're learning. Learn how to play guitar. Once you get that knowledge, then you can move forward and you can try new chords. You can try different songs, you know. So it's the same thing with cooking. You know, read the page. It tells you, add the olive oil in the pan, dust the chicken and flour seasoned with sea salt and black pepper. When the pan heats up, put the chicken into the pan. If about 2 or 3 minutes later, turn the chicken over. Add the mushrooms to the pan at this point. You know, so this is how I try to build my recipes and try to build my step-by-step pictures so that they make it. So it's hard. If you actually read the blog post, it's hard not to understand. And believe me, I get questions. Oh, it's right there. You couldn't see it? You know, so I have to answer them back. Say, yeah, it's in the post, yada, yada, yada.
Well, and there's an intimidation factor because...
Oh, yeah.
The thing about a blog versus the cookbook is at least there's possibly a way to interact with the person who wrote it.
Yeah.
And your cookbook, you know, you're looking at a Jacques Pepin La Technique and you're not talking to Jacques. It's just that's not going to happen. You're depending on these really crappy black and white pictures. And
And where I might understand a little more of what Jacques is saying, not everything, because I'm not a French cooking specialist either. A novice has a really hard time with some of them, because one of the things I really had to learn was to explain it more succinctly. You know, once someone had said, you know, they do not have your experience. You know, you think just add this to the pan, they understand what you mean. No, you have to write down more why or what it's doing. So I try to include that a lot of times, or, you know, why you're doing something. There'll be a frequently asked questions. That's the new thing we do on the blog now. And it'll explain some of the things that you've done. So, you know, and again, it can be fun if you let it. You know, don't be intimidated and look at it as a fun experience. And again, don't start with something that looks like it's going to, don't start with something that's going to take half a day to make, or it's going to take hours to make, or it's going to have ingredients that are going to require some skill. Start with something simple.
Yeah, don't make a ballotine or galantine on your very first trying kitchen.
That's
not a good idea.
No.
I mean, work toward it, but.
Yeah.
So I think what we're saying is set expectations at a reasonable level. You know, you're right about the further explanation, and I discovered that trying to teach. I have some exceptionally talented line cooks who flat out refused to make biscuits and muffins. I ain't doing it. I'll go cater 1,000 people, 9 courses. I'm not making muffins. Dude, it's muffins.
Yeah.
So figuring out how to make that information, that process accessible to somebody who clearly could do it, but there's this wall they have to get through.
Yep.
And so it makes sense to me that there's like, I don't have, I think it's an information level for comfort where they, and once that confidence comes from that first success, it's like, wow, look what I did. It's kind of a proud moment, and it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what you build on. You've made that first thing successfully because you used ingredients you like. And it wasn't, you know, there wasn't 15 ingredients in it. It was something relatively simple. And now you move on to something else. And then somewhere down the path, then you're going to be using those recipes that have 15 or 20 ingredients in it. You know, you're feeling comfortable now. And it's like, it's no big deal. You know, I can do this.
Right.
You know, where when you look at when you started, the same thing with me. I started that job prepping. The first night I worked for this restaurant, at the end of the night, I went to the owner, the chef, and said, Bob, I wish I'd been more help. He goes, yeah, I wish you had too.
But you showed up.
Yeah, so start there. And by the end of that season, I was in the corner cooking.
Good.
Okay. So, you know, it's getting out of your, you know, it's learning. It's like anything. You need to try and you need to learn and you need to start somewhere. You know, maybe the recipes you're using aren't the best, but it's a place to start. So as you start and you get more familiar, you start to learn what you can and can't do with food. I mean, you start to learn, well, you know, I blackened that mahi. Well, I think I blackened it a little too long because it's really black. or you learn processes that you're trying to experiment. And you learn processes. And everything is a learning experience. So it's something that's adding to your knowledge and to your repertoire, and it's making you a better overall cook. Everybody fails. When I first started learning to bake, I would go in, you know, I got sold with a restaurant, and I asked the owner what we were doing for desserts. He goes, oh, chef, that's up to you. And the owner, the previous owner's mother, had made all the desserts. I went, oh, crap. So I ordered a Good Housekeeping Illustrated cookbook of desserts. And funny as it may seem, a lot of their desserts were classical interpretations of the classics. I did not know that for a few years afterwards. And I would make the dessert. No one was there. If it didn't turn out, it never happened. It went in the trash and I would start again.
Right.
You know, so you can't really do that with food, with expensive food, but there's a lot of ways to save protein dishes. There's a lot of things do to make them more palatable. You know, you can't really, you can screw things up really bad, but there's a sauce you can put on it. You can chop it and make it into something else. You know, there's all kinds of things you can do to save and recover that item that you're making. Biggest problem I think people have is with seafood, because you always want to cook it too much. And there's a delicate balance between serving it raw and serving it overcooked. It should still be a little bit on the raw side, but not too raw that people are going to look at you like you're crazy. You know, keep that moisture in it.
It's ceviche. So, it's a new thing.
Yeah, yeah. If it is, that's fine. But I mean, like scallops, I still can't wrap my head around eating really raw scallops. I mean, I like them, but it's like, damn, you want to cook them just a little bit more for me? You know, it's like, but again, it's everybody is different with their tastes. You know, if I was in a dock in Norway and they were pulling scallops up out of the water, I would eat one raw because I know it's really fresh. But, you know, if I'm in a restaurant, I don't really know who the chef is or what his source is. I might want him to cook it just a little bit more for me.
One day in the kitchen in Boulay, we were waiting on the delivery. It was 7 o'clock. Service had already started. And we're like, where is the scallop? The guy finally comes in. And it was in that, like, brass-looking tin, but it's not really brass. And so Boulay opened it up, pulled out this giant thing, cut it in half, and you could see the muscles still twitching. He said that.
Wow.
That's fresh. A fresh scallop. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
So
I actually saw a video of them for the first time. They did a lot of scalloping in Florida on the Gulf Coast. And I was watching this video, and the scallop is almost like swimming, and it's opening up its shell, getting food.
Really?
I'm like, I never saw that before. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was moving in the water. I thought they just laid there. I don't know how they ate, but yeah, it's actually like almost swimming. I was like, damn.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you have traveled the world, or at least a good part of it.
Yep.
I'm going to start this with a quote from John Cleese from Monty Python. He said, "A wonderful thing about laughter is that it just destroys any kind of system of dividing people." Yep. Have you found that food can do the same thing, maybe even especially among strangers?
Oh, absolutely. Food is the great bonding tool of all time. A prime example is my wife is very gregarious, and I am not quite so. And I will go do what I'm working, doing, taking pictures, and I come back. We were in Berlin, or Munich. We were in Munich, and she said, sitting down at a table with all these Germans, and I'm going, "You don't speak German. You speak English. That's about it." You know, and she's having a good time, waves me over. There was somebody from Australia that was with them, and then I sat there with them, and we had a great night drinking beer and eating. It had been like a pop-up Oompa festival that happened twice a year, and we just kind of stumbled upon it. And we made friends just because of beer and food and laughter and having a good time. And she's talking to this lady who has a twin sister in California, and they're having a kind of a rough conversation, you know, about her sister that lives there and all this different thing. So I'll tell her, "Stop talking to people. Stop talking to people." Yeah, I walk away from her to get tickets, and I come back and she's talking. Yeah, so she's really good at that. So she drags me out of my shell on that part. But yeah, you know, you can have a bad day, and food can make it better. You can go, like, I travel with groups sometimes, and we'd be on these stinking buses for half a day, and we're just tired and angry, and not angry, but we're not happy because we've been on this damn bus. We want to see something, and then we go to dinner, and all of a sudden, appetizers come out, wine comes out, everybody's happy, you know. So food will do that. It'll take, and we're basically strangers. But, you know, you can sit at a table with strangers and have a meal. And I dare anyone to say that they will not be talking to those people by the end of the night. You know, they may not be friends, but you will be communicating with them some way. We were in Charleston. I think it was Charleston. And we sat down at a community. I love community tables where they have you just go sit down. It's in a restaurant. We sat down to the typical Southern lawyer in a seersucker suit, and he started telling us stories, and I'm like, "Are you supposed to tell us this stuff?" But we had a great conversation, and I'm eating. Goes, "Oh, you're braver than I can't eat that no more. It hardened my arteries, you know." So I'm eating one of these sandwiches piled with pork and all god of things on it, you know. And it was great. We made a friend, you know. When we travel and we go all throughout, we make friends, and a lot of it is because of food. And then you have those memories. So when you eat something, that if you eat that again, then you remember those people and you remember where you were. There was a great country song called "The Song Remembers When" by Trisha Yearwood. And I always say the food remembers when, because it'll take me back to the first time I had tiramisu on the Spanish, at that restaurant by the Spanish Steps in Rome. You know, on a night on Christmas Eve, when it was only for locals, very touristy restaurant the rest of the year. But that night it was only for locals, and they had a hot and cold bar that made me want to cry. It was so beautiful. And then I had tiramisu, and it was like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." So, you know, I'll always go back to these things. And, you know, food is a big part of just joy.
You know, your statement, "the food remembers when," reminds me of the little Proustian Madeleine story. Mm-hmm. And they captured it. The Disney folks or Pixar folks, maybe that's the same thing,
yeah,
captured it perfectly at the very end when Ego's eating ratatouille and drops the fork and he's 4 years old again. That's exactly, yeah. Food has, yeah, this amazing, yeah, time travel capability where you are immediately somewhere else at some other age, and it's a fascinating thing to have happen.
I was in Cancun years ago for one of these vacations and on the beach. And we took a bus a little bit too far and we were in the Mexican area. And I'm half Mexican, you know, so I wasn't worried. My girlfriend was a 5'10" blonde and they're going, "Blondie, hey, Blondie, movie star," you know. But we went into this bakery and I saw pan dulce. I had not seen that, I think, since I was 6. And I remember my grandmother making that for me or getting it for me. And it was like, oh, my God, right away. I walked out of there with bags of stuff, you know, and I ate those pan dulce. And it was just like, yeah, I just remembered. I remembered my grandmother. I remembered how much she loved feeding me. And it was just, it's magical.
It is magical. All right. I have a short answer section I want to get into. This is kind of like, it's not exactly a quick fire, but it kind of is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of the 5 flavors, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, or umami, which one's your favorite?
I think umami.
What's your favorite food?
My favorite food is, I love seafood of almost any kind.
What's your least favorite food?
My least favorite food is calamari.
Right. That's an interesting contrast there. Love seafood, but not that one.
No, not that one. Or scongili either. I was never that fond of that either. I had an early experience with both of those, and it just never really gelled for me afterwards. But I think seafood, you know, it's just – I used to love a bronzini, a good bronzini, before I found out they were farm-raised pretty much. But I still love them. That was a good fish.
What sound do you love?
Laughter.
What sound do you hate?
Oh, crying.
What gets you excited?
Being able to cook for people and letting them experience what I'm creating.
What turns you off?
Oh, just nasty people. People that just, everything's wrong. Negative people.
I've labeled them as people who are determined not to have a good time.
Yeah, there's a lot of them out there.
Especially on Twitter.
Oh, God, yeah.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Ice cream.
In general, do you have like one specific thing that either you make it or is there a brand? And
oh, no, it's just, I like homemade ice cream. You know, there's so many ice cream parlors out there. But, you know, push comes to shove, if I can't find anything but a Dairy Queen, that'll do. You know, it's, you know, I prefer, like right now, my new favorite flavor is Mocha Crunch. There's an ice cream place down the street that makes it. And then we have another one called the Drip and Scoop, and they make all kinds of interesting flavors. You know, we can't keep it in the house. When I first started dating my wife, I told her we had a 3-day rule on ice cream. Buy a half gallon. If you want it, you got 3 days. After that, mine might not be there. So we don't keep it in the house for that very reason.
That's fair warning.
Yeah. I thought so. She wasn't. She wasn't buying.
How can people follow you?
Very simply, I am Ask Chef Dennis on all social media, and I am AskChefDennis.com. So, you know, all you have to do is Google Ask Chef Dennis, and you'll find a couple pages of me.
I will put at least the .com address on today's show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/202.
Okay.
All right. So thank you for your time. I want to move into, we have a few minutes here. How much time do I have?
Okay. We got 15 minutes.
Okay. This is something I call the chef's table. It's for my Patreon supporters. Let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
And this is kind of, this has become a fun thing because I'm getting this, the people who follow the show ask me, what do they like? Mm-hmm. Sweet, salt, and umami is easily the least answered. The most popular one is sweet or salty.
I like them all. That was hard, so I went with, you know, lately what I've been craving.
Fair enough. And maybe you've discovered this. I don't know if you ask people about their flavor profile preferences or even if they've ever thought about it. I worked in New Jersey at mm-hmm. Old York Cellars, not too far from Hillsboro. Mm-hmm. I was the wine taster guy. And so one of them, there was a Malbec that had, I loved it because it had bitter, and I really like bitter. And then I would mm-hmm. give it to people, and in very unofficial survey, only 25% of the people could detect bitter flavors.
Really?
That's interesting to me because there's lots of bitter foods that you maybe never even tasted. Yeah. So three out of four didn't get the bitter olive leathery thing at the end that I was mm-hmm. getting. And that's the thing that made me say, this is the wine for me because of all that. So
yeah.
Like I said, it's not science. It's strictly observational, but it was interesting.
Yeah.
Is there one meal in your memory, and this is, and you've been lots of places, so this is going to be tough, mm-hmm. that really stands out as the great meal?
There have been a lot. God, my wife is funny because when we're eating in a place and the chef comes out, whatever I'm eating at the time is the best thing I've ever eaten. And then I can be subjective later. But I think one of the best meals I've ever had was actually up towards Flemington. And I can't remember the name of the place, but it was an old farmhouse. And they served a game, and they served a bunch of other different things. And it was just exquisite from the beginning to the end. Another one that we had that was really, really, it was very expensive too, was in Sorrento. It was in the cellar of an old cellar of a place. And it was just magnificent. Some of the meals I've had though that I remember that were very good too are not exquisite foods. But they're foods that are just comfort foods too. So I've had some very good comfort meals over the years in Ireland.
Makes sense. So yeah. I'm going to ask you, and this is because you have a background for understanding the question and answering the question and this ruled experience, which I think further enriches the possible answer. Of those meals that you just remembered, and there's a lot of diversity even there,
mm-hmm.
is there a way to assess how much of that meal was the food alone and how much of that experience was the ambience and the location and the rest of the sort of intangible qualities that were just part of the place?
I honestly never place a lot of, I mean, I love that it's pretty. One of the other best meals I had was in Lucerne. It was all Asian style. And that was a knockout looking place. But I it can be beautiful. And I've learned this. The place can be beautiful. The ambiance can be amazing. And the food can suck. So I pretty much just place all my emphasis on the food itself. The creativity of the chef and the ingredients he's using.
Okay. I don't remember. It was years ago. I have no idea. It was a book I was reading, and the argument from the author was, she was talking about Italian food, that you can't make, and she was talking specifically about Tuscan food, you can't make authentic Tuscan food anywhere in the world except Tuscany. And her argumentation was because it's not just the beef, it's the sound of those particular birds and the sound of those, the wind and the brooks and everything mm-hmm. else that happens in Tuscany is unique to that spot. But then the argument is the same that you can't make my food anywhere except my house. I mean, it can get that small. And I understand the argument. It gets, I think, to a point of ridiculousness.
Yeah.
But there's a valid argument to be made, at least, that to get the real experience need be in the real place. And I heard the show yesterday that you, and the irony was you had, I think the best Chinese food you ever had was in Paris, France. I think, well, yeah. That's unexpected.
Well, and that's because I've never been to China, you know, so.
Fair enough. Okay.
There you go. If I'd been to China, I probably would have not said that, but I've never been to China. And, but yeah, it's hard to be subjective to something like that. Now, one of the things I learned when I was cooking, you know, I was one of those old style chefs that I'm not giving you the recipe. Oh, no, 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 no. And then when I started blogging, I had to be perfect. So I wanted to make sure everything was in there. Everything was in there that I was making. And as I started to go out, you know, I'd say how good something was. The server would say, would you like the recipe? I'll get it from the chef. And I'm like, really? So it was kind of a reawakening. And what it made me realize was, like you said, it'll never be quite as good as it was there because you're missing different aspects of the meal. So they're not afraid on giving you the recipe because I want you to make it and I want you to say, this is delicious. But in my restaurant, it was like, oh, I think Dennis made it a little bit better. You know, I want you to be happy with what you're making. So I think that's part of what you're saying is, you know, it goes back to I'm always going to do just a little tweak different that maybe you're not going to do it that way. Or maybe I source my product somewhere else than you can source it, and that's going to make a difference. So, you know,
I agree with that. I know that I have a tendency because I like not necessarily upfront bold flavors, but I like profound flavors. So I will push the caramelization limit on everything because I know I'm getting that back end, that deep, rich. And here everyone's like, they just expect this. They go, whatever, it's the same old, you know, dad's cooking again. But when I do it for people who don't eat my food all the time, they're like, how did you do that? And it is that years of experience, but it's easy for the home cook to start to do.
Yes.
I understand that they're afraid they're going to burn it. Well, burn doesn't happen immediately. There's sight, sound, and smell things going on before it gets to burn. And when it gets to burn, now you've made garbage. So that's too far. But that's a practice thing. You mentioned, I'm going to ask a different question. I was curious about if your Mexican heritage comes into your cooking, but I'm going to ask you this one instead. And I asked this of Milo Sihelka, the first certified master chef. I worked for him in Michigan. And the assistant F&B heard me ask, chef, is your wife a good cook? And she just about spit out her food. She's like, do you know who you're talking to? Yes. Yes, I know who I'm talking to. I think this is a valid question. Dennis, is your wife cook?
Oh, hell no. She tried, bless her heart. She tried. She bought a Rachel Ray's 30-minute books, and she was trying. And I said, just make me Kraft macaroni and cheese and fish sticks, just so I don't have to cook one night. I don't care. You know, it was not a pretty thing. And I had just redone the kitchen, and she had used 5 pots and made 3 things. And I'm standing there looking, how did you do that? So that was the last night we had dinner with Lisa. But, you know, that's not her wheelhouse. She loves to eat, though, and I've turned her into a bit of a food snob. But
way to go.
Yeah, I know.
Funny, funny, funny. Well, my wife can cook because she was a single college student, and so she had to get on somehow. She worked in restaurants partly because that's where the food was.
Yeah.
But when you marry a guy who knows how to cook, there's not a whole lot of incentive to do that.
Nope. There's no reason. So, and I'm happy to do it because she is still my, my audience. You know, I don't get to cook for a lot of different people all the time anymore. So she is still my audience. And when I make something new, I can always tell she doesn't like it because she becomes 6 years old and she cuts it and just moves it around the plate. And I'm like, you don't like it? Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. It says, no, you don't have to eat it. If you don't like it, that's okay. And she goes, oh, it's just not my taste. You know, it's like, but other times she just won't stop eating. And I know that was a good meal. But, you know, if she's just moving it around the plate, it wasn't a success.
Right. So, well, but
doesn't mean it wasn't good. It just wasn't her.
So there's a tweak possibility there.
Yeah.
Very good. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add the link to Dennis's website on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/202. Grilling is one of the best ways to get the heat out of your kitchen in the summer, and it cooks fast. You'll want to check those chicken breasts or pork chops to make sure they're done. Using a reliable and quick reading thermometer gets that done quickly, so you're certain everybody is happy and safe. Check out the selection of digital instant read thermometers with my link at culinarylibertarian.com/cheftemp. The chef's table portion of my talk with Dennis is up on the Patreon members section. It's a good chat, and I think you're going to like it. You can get access to that portion of the chef's table and all the rest of them by becoming a Patreon at culinarylibertarian.com/support. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Thanks also to my Patreon supporters. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.